This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, 50 years after the war on poverty, poor people's programs are under more assault than ever. It's been 43 years since the FBI's COINTELPRO secrets were revealed, and a new book asks folks to imagine what socialism would look like in the USA.
But first, the Internal Revenue Service is threatening to put IFCO, the Interreligious Foundation for Community Organization, out of business. Gail Walker is co-director of IFCO, which funds independent community organizing and holds an annual caravan of aid to Cuba. She explains what the IRS is up to.
Once again, the IRS powers that be are coming after us. This time, they are threatening to revoke our tax-exempt status, our 501c3 nonprofit status. This follows a two-year audit by the IRS of our books, and we learned that this call for an audit was actually triggered by two members of Congress. Actually, one is a former member of Congress, a Republican from North Carolina, Sue Myrick. She's also a Tea Party supporter, and a Democrat from California by the name of Brad Sherman, who had written letters to Attorney General Eric Holder and the IRS Commissioner questioning our role in providing fiscal sponsorship for a project known as Viva Palestina. Actually, it's the U.S. component of Viva Palestina, which is a U.K.-based charity that has taken humanitarian aid to the people of Gaza. And the attack by the IRS, sort of a scathing report pulled together by the forensic investigator, also takes fault with our solidarity work with Cuba. The friendshipment caravan that we have organized for the past 22 years and the support of U.S. students interested in taking advantage of the scholarship opportunities that Cuba is offering for the medical school scholarship.
Let's deal with the Gaza situation first. So they're construing that any dealings with or aid to Palestinians in Gaza is somehow support for what they have designated as a terrorist organization, Hamas.
Yeah, what they have done is made these broad arcs, these overreaching claims that by providing fiscal sponsorship with Viva Palestina, which is taking humanitarian aid to the people of Gaza, that somehow both Viva Palestina and IFCO are aiding terrorists. Hamas is the legally elected government of Gaza. So there's this attempt to kind of, with a broad stroke, also just disrespect the voice of the people of Gaza. But the point is that we were working with Viva Palestina. Viva Palestina was working with non-governmental agencies, including the Red Cross and other non-governmental organizations, to deliver this aid. This is what the project was all about. This was always the intent and what they actually were able to accomplish.
And, of course, the United Nations deals with the Palestinians of Gaza and with the government of Gaza, which is headed by Hamas, every day.
Absolutely. And as a matter of fact, the United Nations has announced that 2014 is the year of solidarity with the Palestinian people, I understand. So you're right. That happens all the time. And IFCO's history has been to be in support of people who have been oppressed or beleaguered by often U.S. policies. So whether that be here in the United States, in Cuba, in Chiapas, Nicaragua, Africa, and certainly in Palestine. So it's just keeping with the historical work that IFCO has always been associated with. And I think it's worth noting that the IRS has used pretext for claiming the connection between Viva Palestina and Hamas. They back this up by quoting a blogger by the name of Stephen Emerson, who directs the Investigative Project on Terrorism. It's a very reactionary sort of right-wing blog, and they claim that he's their terrorism expert. But there is a lot of documentation that really sort of proves that this fellow has done very shoddy reporting, that his own tax-exempt status is questionable. I think it was the Charity Navigator, certainly one of those groups that really monitors nonprofit organizations, have issued an alert about his own dealings. But to have the IRS, a U.S. agency, government agency, utilize a blog to come after a legitimate 47-year-old faith-based nonprofit organization run by people of color since its inception as the proof that somehow we are connected with aiding terrorism is just an outrage and an insult.
Well, of course, the IRS is not a force unto itself. It's a branch of the U.S. government, as you said. So do you characterize this as an attack by the administration on IFCO?
I think that we can only look at it in that way. This is not the first time that IFCO has come under attack by U.S. government forces. The IRS has attempted to put us through long and winding audits in the past, and we've come out on top. The Treasury Department, through its Office of Foreign Assets Control, the entity in Treasury that enforces the embargo, the blockade against Cuba, has tried to come after us time and time again for our caravans of friendship with the Cuban people. There have been different efforts to try to get lists of our supporters from our bank to try to come after them. We've successfully defeated the government in those efforts. Again, that was through Treasury. So there have been time and time again where different arms of the U.S. government have attempted to try to negatively impact our work and to try to threaten our supporters. And we've been able to successfully, you know, weather those challenges. And we're fighting this attack in the same way and are confident that right will prevail and that we will be able to successfully defeat this attack.
This administration claims that it's trying to reach a rapprochement with Cuba, but this is evidence to the opposite.
Yeah, it's ironic because I think in so many ways the U.S. government's policy toward Cuba has been for many, many years inconsistent, arbitrary. Here's yet another case where on the one hand, this sort of public persona where the perception that they want to put out there is that there's an effort to work with Cuba. And then on the other hand, there are these sort of backhanded approaches to really trying to threaten organizations that have been offering friendship and trying to pursue a different policy as it relates to Cuba and educating people about the vicious impact of the U.S. blockade against Cuba. So there's this kind of contradictory, almost schizophrenic behavior or attitude when it comes to the United States and Cuba, and I think that this is another example of that at play.
IFCO is, of course, not rich. Is this putting a chill among your benefactors, your donors?
Well, you know, ironically, Glenn, it's really been the exact opposite. We've gotten people who have been calling, who've been stopping by the office, who've been writing checks and saying, we have to fight this, recognizing that an attack on IFCO of this nature is an attack on all progressive issues that many of our supporters hold dear to heart. I think that there's really a groundswell of support that has been reached as a result of this attack, and that's precisely why we think it's important to spread the word, to let people know that not only is this attack happening, but that it's unjust, it's immoral, it's unfair, and we're going to fight it, and we're counting on our supporters to help us in that regard, and they've been really kind of coming out of the woodwork.
But it is an added burden, and legal defense against the IRS does cost money.
There's no doubt about that. There is an effort to raise money. We've got to raise money for a legal defense, and that does come with its own level of burden. We think it's important for our network, our supporters, to not get detracted from the important work that needs to be done. That is the caravan that we're organizing this summer. That is the next group of medical school students that we plan to take down to Cuba. And that is the dozens of nonprofit organizations that we provide fiscal sponsorship for here in the United States to continue to lift up their work and to provide that support. So it's a challenge. It comes with an extra burden, but we think it's important for people to be aware of what the IRS is doing, but at the same time to not allow their vicious campaign and attack to distract us, progressive-minded people, from the important work that we've been doing and need to continue to do as we move forward.
That was Gail Walker of IFCO, in New York.
Boston-based United for a Fair Economy has released its annual State of the Dream report for 2014. It's titled Healthcare for Whom? Enduring Racial Disparities. The progressive think tank held a press conference with representatives of the NAACP and community organizations from Alabama, Florida, and Louisiana, states that have refused to expand their Medicaid programs under the administration's Affordable Care Act. Brian Miller is executive director of United for a Fair Economy. He says ongoing racial economic gaps also create racial health disparities.
Racial segregation and concentrated poverty effectively create a toxic soup of health problems and challenges for communities of color. Blacks and Latinos significantly lag behind whites in income and wealth. Black and Latino households hold only 13 cents of net wealth to every dollar that the median white household holds. Black and Latino families earn 64 and 63 cents, respectively, to every dollar that white families earn. Black and Latinos are more likely to be unemployed, even when taking education into account. That is, among college graduates alone, if you just limit this to those with a bachelor's degree, 6.3% of blacks, 5.1% of Latinos are unemployed, compared to only 3.7% of whites. In short, vast economic disparities are still with us, and these disparities, coupled with continued racial segregation, create a toxic soup that is brewing up health problems and shortening people's lives. Racial segregation pushes more people of color into communities of concentrated poverty. Poor blacks are 7 times as likely as poor whites. Poor Latinos are 6 times as likely as poor whites to live in high poverty neighborhoods. And these are neighborhoods that lack adequate health care facilities. They're neighborhoods that often lack a full-service grocery store. You can't buy healthy food even if you wanted to without driving miles. These are communities that often lack green space or parks to walk and jog and engage in healthy activities. And even when those parks are present, high crime rates prevent parents from allowing their children to use them. They keep their children indoors as soon as they get home from school. These high poverty communities are also facing a disproportionate share of environmental toxins. There was a lot of recent reporting about the asthma epidemic from black mold. We know that these communities are subjected to higher levels of lead. We also know that they're also subjected to higher levels of industrial pollutants from the siting of facilities. The end result of all this should elicit moral outrage. Black men die an average of 5 years earlier than white men. Black women die 4 years earlier than white women. And this really goes to the core of what Dr. King says. Of all forms of inequality, injustice in healthcare is the most shocking and inhumane. We agree, and that's why we wrote this report. We have a problem in the United States. And this is where we get into issues of when things become structurally embedded in the economic system, that you don't even have to be intentional about racism, but you're still going to get racist impacts and disparate racial outcomes. And our employer-based healthcare is an example of that. One could make an argument that there's nothing inherently racist, there's nothing intentionally racist, at least, in an employer-based healthcare model. It's just a model for healthcare. But because that healthcare model is built on top of another system that we know has a lot of documented racism, the job sector, we get racial outcomes. That is, in the employment sector, we know that people with black-sounding resumes are going to get shuffled to the bottom of the stack. We know that people of color are going to be less likely to be considered for managerial positions. We know that a host of factors keep people of color out of significant job opportunities. As a result, black and Latino households are more likely to work minimum wage jobs, part-time jobs, low-wage jobs, temporary jobs, and non-managerial jobs, all of which are less likely to provide health insurance for communities of color. And as a result, communities of color, Latinos, and African Americans lag significantly behind whites in their coverage rates. And the only way we're going to ever fix it entirely is with a single-payer system. And if you look at Medicare for 65 and older, there is essentially no disparities between black and white and Latino in health insurance coverage once you limit it to 65 and older, because that's essentially a single-payer system. It's no longer dependent on the employment sector. Now, the Affordable Care Act obviously doesn't go that far, but it does make really positive progress towards closing the vast racial disparities in health insurance. It does it through a number of measures, including the health exchanges, which we've all heard about, but more importantly, through the expansion of the Medicaid program for all adults, whether they have children or not, up and their children, obviously, up to 138% of poverty. This is a huge addition to the Medicaid program that's going to ensure a lot of people, millions of people, 10 million people who previously would not have had insurance. Unfortunately, even that is under attack by the opponents of the Affordable Care Act, which is commonly known as Obamacare. We now have 25 states that are not going to be expanding their Medicaid program under the ACA in 2014. All but three of those are headed by Republican governors. So we now have this, what we call the 25-state coverage gap, through which 5 million Americans will now fall. These are people who are predominantly people of color. Blacks make up only 13% of the nation's population, but they account for 27% of those who are going to fall through the new 25-state coverage gap. And this is in part because every state in the South where large numbers of African Americans live, with the exception of Arkansas, is rejecting Medicaid expansion. That needs to be fixed. Latinos make up about 15% of the population. Once you take out undocumented immigrants, you're looking at 15% of the population. Yet they account for 21% of those who fall through the new 25-state coverage gap. This is in part because of the decisions of both Texas and Florida to not expand their Medicaid program. In fact, 1 million of the 5 million people, or nearly 5 million who will go without insurance now, live in Texas. And that's a state that's 38% Latino. So what we are seeing is this 25-state coverage gap and the attack on the Affordable Care Act is disproportionately hitting communities of color.
Your emphasis is on defending the Affordable Care Act. Much of your report concerns the benefits of Medicaid expansion and talks about the great deficits that result from those 25 states that have opted out of Medicaid expansion. Doesn't all of this dramatize the necessity to demand a real single-payer program?
As United for Fair Economy, we unapologetically support, you know, single payer. That's what we need to do, Medicare for all. That said, we know that may be a far off challenge, and there are policy changes that can be made right now that will make a profound difference in people's lives. And I, for one, am not going to be so ideologically pure that we let people suffer in the here and now because it isn't as perfect as we would like it to be. So, yes, we're supporting the Medicaid expansion in those 25 states and doing everything we can to support those efforts to close that 25-state coverage gap. And at the same time, though, we're supporting states like Vermont and encouraging other states to go further if it's within the political possibilities of their state.
Brian Miller, Executive Director of United for a Fair Economy in Boston.
This marks the 50th year since President Lyndon Johnson declared war on poverty. We spoke with several experts on the poverty programs of that era. Annalise Orlock is a professor of history at Dartmouth University and co-editor of the book The War on Poverty, A Grassroots History, 1964 through 1980. Half a century ago and today, opponents of Poor People's Program say that throwing money at poverty program doesn't work, but Professor Orlock says the war on poverty was a great success.
No, they work, and they work very well, and they tend to work very quickly. So that within a decade after Lyndon Johnson had initiated war on poverty programs, the child poverty rate was cut in half. From that time to 2012, the poverty rate was cut by something like 40%. Now, the right likes to say that there are more poor people now than there were before the programs went into existence. That is true numerically. There are also a larger number of people in the population. So the other thing is that the measure of poverty is a little bit off. And if you measure poverty accurately and you don't take people out of the ranks of the impoverished if they're receiving poverty programs, right? You admit that those who are receiving poverty aid get it because they're poor. Then we find also that the impact of those programs has been tremendous. And qualitatively, it's been tremendous. So what I mean by that is that Before the war on poverty, you had no food stamps program, you had no women and infant children nutrition program and medical care, you had no Medicaid and Medicare. And the introduction of all those programs has meant that we don't see the signs of poverty that we did before. We don't see long-term malnutrition. We don't see rickets and soft bones and open sores and, you know, some of the kinds of mental deficits that we did as a result of long-term malnutrition. All those, in my mind, are dramatic successes. The community health care program actually expanded life expectancies in poor neighborhoods. People literally live longer than before the community health centers were first opened up. And finally, poor people got involved in the political process. And that's something we've seen less of since the programs have been cut because, frankly, that made a lot of politicians run scared. It shook things up when poor people got involved in the political process and demanded representation on school boards and housing boards and welfare boards and even started to run for office and register other poor people to vote. All of those things shook up the political establishment, and so one of the reasons that it's so popular to attack the war on poverty is not because it failed, but because it succeeded.
Yes, and with poor people not organizing today in the numbers that we saw in the 60s in defense of their economic rights, it seems only to encourage the austerity forces.
Yeah, I think that that's really true. One of the things that was powerful about Lyndon Johnson's declaration of a war on poverty 50 years ago is that it made poor people feel that it was indeed a moral imperative for the country to try to fight poverty. And the Economic Opportunity Act of 1964 required, quote-unquote, maximum feasible participation by the poor themselves. And so even though we have a lot of the same services now, we have the medical care where it wasn't before and the libraries where they weren't before, we in the community service agencies, we don't have poor people getting involved to the same degree. And the government can promote that, and it's successful. And it acknowledges that poor people know what their communities need. And if we recruit them and give them a little bit of income to provide services to their communities, that they actually do a pretty good job of it.
You're the author of a book called Storming Caesar's Palace, How Black Mothers Fought Their Own War on Poverty. Now, of course, blacks have never made up the majority of people in poverty, but black folks certainly took the leadership role in fighting against poverty.
Exactly. And black women were very much the leaders of anti-poverty work in the 1960s, the National Welfare Rights Organization, and a lot of the local branches of the welfare rights struggle. And in that role, they did a number of things. First of all, even after Congress passed the Food Stamp Act and free lunch and breakfast programs in the schools had been on the books since the 40s, but in all of these cases, women and infant children nutrition program as well, in all of these cases, the money was not released to the states. The programs were passed, but they weren't funded. Poor mothers sued, and a lot of them were poor black mothers who sued in states across the country to release funding for those programs, and then they did organizing to educate people across lines of race and gender that they were eligible, they were entitled to get food stamps, to have their children screened for illnesses and treated for free if the screening showed that they needed it. And they opened clinics. They ran community newspapers. They did tremendous work in making the war on poverty a vibrant success. And so we owe that generation of single mothers, but definitely, especially black single mothers, a real debt of gratitude.
The National Welfare Rights Organization used to be in the news, it looked like, every day. What happened to the NWRO, and has any other group or groups emerged to fill the void?
Well, the National Welfare Rights Organization began to lose its funding when the charismatic male leader, a chemistry professor by the name of George Wiley, died in the early 70s in a boating accident. And he was kind of the middle class voice of the movement and the charismatic male voice of the movement. And he was very good at tapping funders. And when the movement was actually run by poor women themselves, and particularly by women from Los Angeles named Johnny Tillman and from New York named Beulah Sanders, they didn't get the kind of funds that that they were getting before, and so the organization drifted and dwindled and ultimately went under in 1975. However, into the 80s and 90s, you had these local organizations that continued tapping into war on poverty programs, and the Comprehensive Education and Training Act, CETA, originally passed under Richard Nixon, and the Youth Employment Training Program. They started local agencies to hire people in their communities, and sometimes they were the biggest employers in their communities, getting people off the welfare rolls and into little jobs of various kinds in their communities. In the years since those particular programs were repealed, it's been harder for poor people's organizations to keep going. But there are still welfare rights organizations. They sometimes talk to each other on the web. On the eve of the 1996 Welfare Reform Act, there were Have a Heart demonstrations on Valentine's Day with poor mothers and their kids in state capitals across the country. But there was not a whole lot of media coverage, so we don't realize it. And I think the media was more sympathetic to NWRO in its heyday, and that's one reason we knew about it and we don't know about what's going on now. But there's definitely important things going on now on the community level in many parts of the country. There's organizing among college students on welfare in the City University of New York system. Their numbers are nearly 30,000. And so I think we do see some important organizing going on now, and we have to find ways to publicize it.
And yet today, even the word welfare is one that, even liberals avoid.
Yeah, and I think that's absolutely true. And that was one of Ronald Reagan's great successes. He didn't actually, as president, repeal most of the war on poverty programs, even though he promised to. And in some cases, like the earned income tax credit, he actually expanded. George W. Bush expanded the food stamp program, now known as SNAP, more than any other president since the war on poverty days. But the rhetoric is to attack poor single mothers and people on welfare as somehow, you know, parasitical and fraudulent. And the truth is that the evidence never bore that out. It never did. It never showed that there was a great deal of cheating. People did what they could and what they needed to survive. I'm sure sometimes there was cheating, but certainly less than you find in the corporate sector, certainly less than, you know, we found on Wall Street in 2008 and, you know, in the defense industry. So I think that's the big success of the Reagan Revolution, and I think it's something that we have to fight against. Got to use the P word, poverty. Got to honor poor single mothers for trying to take care of their kids and not blame them for seeking a little government assistance doing so. I mean, you know, what do we pay taxes for?
And in fact, it's hard work being poor.
It's such hard work. It's such hard work. And, it's really been an eye-opener for me to now live in a rural area where I teach. And I grew up in Brooklyn, New York, and I thought I understood poverty there. It's a whole different thing here. And I think also very invisible. People living on back roads, you know, sometimes without telephones, without cars. It's hard work. It's exhausting. And being stigmatized on top of that makes it all that much harder for people to get out of poverty. It's one of the reasons the war on poverty was so great, by getting people involved in their communities. And I interview people in the movement. They talk about feeling like they mattered in those days and they could help other people. And that gave them the emotional strength and the sense of self to, you know, to pull themselves up a little bit. While there are many programs that still exist from the war on poverty years, most of the big ones, what we don't have is an ability to talk about public jobs. And public jobs programs are something that even Lyndon Johnson shied away from. Richard Nixon and Jimmy Carter and the Congresses that were passing legislation in their day were a little more willing to look at it. You know, it was a time when Coretta Scott King and Ruby Duncan, who I write about in the Las Vegas movement, they were lobbying for full employment. And I think we need to go back to thinking about that, because government jobs programs also work. They worked in the New Deal era. They contributed a great deal, even if they didn't end the Depression, they contributed a great deal to our society, and they gave people some economic security through work. And I think that that's a direction that we really need to look at. There's an awful lot that needs to be done in our country, from infrastructure to mentoring of young children to rebuilding our schools and hospitals. And I think that we can turn again to this idea of public jobs programs, I think particularly among young people. So many communities, the rate of unemployed young people is just devastatingly high. That's not good for anybody, and it's certainly not good for the future of our society as a whole. So that's one direction that I'd really like to see us go as we commemorate the 50th anniversary of the War on Poverty.
That was Professor Annalise Orlick at Dartmouth University in New Hampshire.
Jill Quadongo teaches sociology at Florida State University. She's author of the book, The Color of Welfare, How Racism Undermined the War on Poverty. Professor Quadongo says a lot has changed in a half century. Even Republican President Richard Nixon seriously considered supporting a guaranteed national minimum income.
Well, we have to put that in the context of the 1960s. It was a time when people really believed much more powerfully than they do today that the government could do good. And Nixon's plan came on the wake of Johnson's war on poverty that created job training programs, community action, VISTA, Medicare, Medicaid, a whole series of programs that impacted people in almost every aspect of their lives. And so Nixon's plan was that everybody in the country would receive a guaranteed minimum income. At that time, it was $300 a month per person. And that gradually, with work effort, you would be able to keep part of that so that the lowest paid worker would still be better off than a non-worker. And the idea of that was to eliminate all of the various poverty programs, which at the time was AFDC, Aid to Families with Dependent Children, and all the benefits that went along with that, and just to create one, simplify the whole social welfare system with one guaranteed minimum income and then a subsidy for wage work to encourage work. So it had some appeal for both liberals and conservatives. And it's an idea that now I think would be totally impossible to even conceive of such an idea. But what happened to it was that it actually got through the House of Representatives. It received a positive vote. But it got killed in the Senate because of a coalition of a variety of different groups that normally don't work together. Southern Democrats didn't like it because they felt like the guaranteed minimum income was actually higher than the wages that a lot of Southerners received, and that it would undermine the low-wage labor force, even though the idea was to encourage work. Some organizations of welfare mothers, particularly in the New York area, opposed it because they were actually receiving higher welfare benefits, and in high-cost areas like New York and L.A., they would have lost income. Organized labor didn't like it because it felt like to them that it was a subsidy for low-wage labor that would have undermined union wages. And so we had a variety. Even some church groups opposed it because they feared that it would entrench the government and the government would take over responsibility that belonged with local communities and families. And so this curious coalition ended any hope that that program would succeed, and it died in the Senate. But the idea at the time was so revolutionary. What we did get out of it, however, was the earned income tax credit that was enacted in 1975 and that was put into place during the Carter administration and then expanded greatly under Clinton, even under Reagan to some extent. And that basically gives working people back pretty much all of their payroll taxes, and then for lower income workers, a subsidy beyond that. So many people pay no taxes and then get an additional amount back. And the earned income tax credit is very appealing, again, for some of the same reasons that the negative income tax, Nixon's plan, because it rewards work. And so both conservatives and liberals have supported it and supported its expansion over several decades.
You say that's an idea that is totally impossible to conceive of today, but what are we talking about today? What are progressives pushing today in the face of austerity?
Well, one of the ideas is to reduce income inequality. And that you hear more and more about. You've heard President Obama talk about reducing income inequality, that income inequality has increased substantially over the last few decades, and that we should do something to reduce that. So that's a grand goal, but the question is how much income inequality is okay. What do we tolerate in terms of income inequality, and how do we reduce it? The best way to reduce it would be to tax more affluent people more and redistribute more income to the poor. The first part of that equation is generally popular, but when you talk about redistributing wealth, you start getting into less feasible ideas for a lot of people. I think we've already done one ambitious thing, which is the Affordable Care Act, the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act, which will help people maintain their income because it provides free health insurance for poor and low-income people by expanding Medicaid, and it also provides subsidies through the exchanges so that working people with low and moderate incomes can have funds that will help them pay for health insurance. And having health insurance coverage is a way to avoid bankruptcy and helps to protect people's assets and savings. So I think the one thing that President Obama has done that is not yet appreciated and is obviously still very controversial is to provide a route for people to have health insurance that will protect their income and provide greater security.
As you say, President Obama now is talking a lot about income inequalities. His answer is promise zones. Do promise zones bear any relationship to the war on poverty as we knew it?
Promise zone ideas have periodically reappeared in American politics, and the closest thing that we had during Johnson's war on poverty were the community action programs where local groups within communities would apply for grants, and they could then start community health centers that would provide medical services, food banks, job and literacy training, drug rehabilitation, even migrant workers assistance. So they weren't zones in the same sense as these promise zones, but they were money that went to communities for community improvement. Some of those worked very well, and we still have some community health centers that began in the 1960s. In other places, the programs became entangled in the struggle for civil rights and created a white backlash against the programs, and so they were cut back substantially. For instance, one program was called Operation Star, that went to two Catholic priests in Mississippi. Mississippi at that time was entirely segregated in terms of just about every phase of life. And what STAR did was to create racially integrated vocational training programs that included black and white teachers and black and white students. It was the first racial integration education in the state of Mississippi. And they had the facilities of the Catholic Church where they could bypass the local segregated school system entirely. But what happened was that there was a huge backlash against STAR, as you can imagine, in 1966 in Mississippi, and eventually the funds were cut for the program. So the war on poverty didn't have promise zones in the same sense of what Obama is talking about, although there have been other similar efforts. The problem is a continuous stream of funding and good administration. So it's a hopeful thing, and we will just have to wait and see how this actually works.
Isn't it logical, however, that programs that would empower poor people would become entangled or be subject to white backlash or business backlash?
Yes, I mean, that was the pattern with a lot of the anti-poverty programs in the 1960s and 70s as well. For instance, one of the more ambitious programs of the War on Poverty was job training. And this was to train poor, less educated people for jobs in the skilled trades, especially for males, jobs as carpenters and brick masons, jobs that paid well. And a high percentage of the trainees in the job training programs were African Americans, because it was targeted at the poor who had less of a chance for education. So it was natural that this would be the constituency. But what happened was, when young black men came out of the job training programs ready to be carpenters, ready to be plumbers, ready to be electricians, and they applied for jobs in cities like Chicago, like Detroit, like Philadelphia, they found that those jobs were closed to them because the trades unions' key negotiating point with employers was that they control hiring. And for decades, they had hired their sons, their nephews. Some places they were controlled by an ethnic group. And so the trainees coming out of the job training programs were a direct threat to their prerogative to choose who was hired on the job. And for the most part, these unions were racially segregated. And so that created a backlash. The trade unions in the skilled trades were a major constituency of the Democratic Party, and that helped turn them eventually into Reagan Republicans, because they resented being forced to hire trainees that weren't members of the unions, or to make these trainees into union members to allow them to become a part of the union. And that was really the beginning of affirmative action, was the skilled trade jobs. How do you prove that unions aren't discriminating? Well, you have to have some sort of numbers of what percent of individuals on the job are minorities, and that means quotas, and quotas create backlash. So that's the perfect example of that kind of backlash being created by programs intended to do well.
One of your books is titled The Color of Welfare: How Racism Undermined the War on Poverty. How much does racism have to do with popular support for today's austerity?
I think that there is less overt racism than there was in the 1960s, in the sense that you don't see colored white signs on drinking fountains, on entrances to hospitals, in schools, but there's coded racial messages that still trigger racial resentment. For instance, during the last presidential campaign, when Newt Gingrich talked about cutting back food stamps, I believe that he was also implying that racial minorities are the undeserving poor who receive food stamps because they don't want to work. And I think people hear that code in those messages and understand that that's what is really being discussed. When President Reagan promised to cut back welfare as we know it, he talked about the welfare mother driving around in a Cadillac, you know, and using her food stamps to buy beer. So those are coded, maybe not so overt, but still coded racial messages that are present today in discussions about policy debates.
Jill Quadagno of Florida State University.
A new book is out that for the first time reveals the identity of three people who broke into the offices of the FBI in Media, Pennsylvania in 1971 and made public the files on the Bureau's COINTEL program. The book is titled The Burglary, The Discovery of J. Edgar Hoover's Secret FBI. Mumia Abu-Jamal, the nation's best-known political prisoner, appeared on WBAI Pacifica Radio, Law and Disorder, hosted by National Lawyers Guild Executive Director Heidi Boghossian. Mumia recalls how he first heard about the break-in 43 years ago.
I remember with quite a degree of distinction receiving in the mail a packet full of Xeroxed FBI files. I believe by 1971 I had left the party. And so this was like a double, triple, a blockbuster. I sat and I read through files that really named names and detailed internal affairs of the Black Panther Party of Philadelphia, the national office, other organizations, activists all throughout the city and the region. And it was a mind blower, again, especially. Imagine reading about someone that you lived with as a comrade, as a brother in an organization, you know. For what that means is, for members of the party, we lived in communal apartments and houses. We lived together, we worked out of the same office, and we spent all day together with each other. And to read about lies that were in those files, and then people that you knew for years who were FBI informants and stuff like that, it was absolutely mind-blowing. But it proved everything that we thought, and it kind of confirmed every suspicion. So to see this, the news, right, from Media Pennsylvania, it's quite refreshing and amazing in many respects that these people held that secret for over 40 years.
Do you think they came forth because of the changing attention to NSA surveillance, Ed Snowden, the other whistleblowers who've come forward?
I think they are the linear ancestors of Edward Snowden. You know, back in those days, you had to find paper, right? Not emails or electronic messages. But these were anti-war people, for the most part, living their own lives, but also wanting to make a contribution, right, to the movement, because they were part of the movement. They were part of the anti-war movement. When we talk about Media Pennsylvania, most of us, unless you're of a certain age, it doesn't ring a bell to you, right? Those files that were ripped off from the media offices of the FBI showed that every organization of any kind of notoriety, actors, artists, women's groups, all kinds of organizations were followed by the FBI, you know, for really practicing their constitutional rights. It was mind-blowing, and I remember very, very well. After that, I think that is the one thing that made the Church Commission hearings possible. And it really exposed what was happening all across the country. It's interesting that these files come out now because, you know, for someone who's been reading and writing recently about the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., people know now that the FBI taped hotel rooms where Martin and Ralph David Abernathy and other civil rights activists, you know, were staying, and taped office and phone calls and that kind of stuff. Well, they tried to use those tapes to blackmail Martin King and actually force him into suicide. This was all part of Hoover's plan to destroy the Black Freedom Movement and any movement that was against what the government was doing, any dissenting movement.
Mumia Abu-Jamal on the radio program Law and Disorder.
There's a new book out this month titled Imagine Living in a Socialist USA. It's edited by Michael Smith, Debbie Smith, and Francis Golden, and packed with 31 essays by a range of left writers and activists. Michael Smith says people who call themselves socialists need to get serious about how to build a new society.
Starting with Marx, revolutionaries were hesitant in trying to spell out what the future would be like. They just, you know, thought, well, we'll see what happens, but we really can't give you a roadmap. But that was 150 years ago. And I think now we can see pretty clearly, well, we certainly can see what's going to happen if we don't change things radically. I mean, the polar ice caps are melting. New York temperature went from 0 degrees to 60 degrees in 2 days. And we really are threatened. And I don't want to sound like a prophet of doom, but we really are threatened because of climate change and global warming. We really are threatened with the extinction of humans as a species and all other species. You know, the edges of our country could be underwater in 40 years. That's the truth. And capitalism is a system that has to expand, has to make the profit. It's utterly irrational. It's out of control, and unless we democratically organize and plan this economy, they're going to kill us, literally, through climate change. So I think we have to start envisioning how you could organize things differently. And that's what a lot of this book does. It's got three sections. The first, which was the easiest, was an indictment of capitalism. I mean, all you got to do is wake up in the morning and open your eyes to see what's wrong with this place. But Paul Street really lays out what's gone wrong. And then the middle section of the book, the visionary section, has chapters on just about everything. If we didn't have a capitalist organized society where things are produced only if it makes a profit, and where private property is the great divide between classes and between people. And then the last part of the book is 10 chapters on how we get from here to there, actually how you go about making a socialist transformation of society. So that's how we laid it out.
You've got 31 essays. Obviously, you made a real effort to get a variety of perspectives on socialism. But how did you put together the mix of writers?
We've been at this for a long time. I've been a socialist for 50 years. My wife also. Frances, I would say, 65 years. So we know a lot of people. And we reached out to comrades that we've met and worked with in the movement over the last period of all those years and tried to select people who could write about various aspects of a new brave world. Let me give you an idea of some of the chapters. We've got people writing about how in the future what art would be like, healthcare, housing, food, emotional life, sexuality, racism, law, criminal justice, poverty, immigration, drugs, education, science and technology, women, ecology, the democratic organization of the publicly owned economy. It's kind of a broad, far-reaching vision of how everything would be like if we didn't have a tenth of 1% that rule and control this country. And then the last part has the 10 chapters and how we get from where we are to making what Paul LeBlanc calls in his chapter the Third American Revolution, the Civil War being the second and the War for Independence being the first.
What uses do you envision this book being put to?
I think that we're seeing now a real change in American people's perception of their lot. The Pew organization did a poll a couple years ago, and 49% of young people, and even more amongst African-American young people, but 49% of people generally, young people under the age of 30, said they had a favorable reaction to the word socialism. The Merriam-Webster organization that puts out the dictionary has an online dictionary. And last year, the two most hits words looked up were socialism and capitalism. And just last month, you had this young woman, Kalama Savant, out in Seattle, run as a socialist for city council, ran a socialist campaign against a long-entrenched Democrat, got a huge amount of support from the community and from labor unions, and she won. And then just recently, they tried to red bait Bill de Blasio when he was running for mayor, calling him a socialist. And the more they tried to red bait him, the more support he got. And he wound up winning by a landslide. So people are thinking, we want to look at a different way because this one just isn't working out. So one of the uses we can put to this book is just having a discussion about how things could be different. And once people start thinking that there's an alternative, the old world can fall quickly. And we want to be part of that discussion. And the other thing we did in the book is we've got people contributing from different tendencies, different political parties. And I think that as the radicalization deepens in this country, as we see that going on, there's going to be a reshuffle and a regroupment, and people should start to come together. And the book is a contribution, I think, to that process.
The book seems to be very heavy with people who would call themselves democratic socialists. Was this on purpose?
Well, the powers that be have slandered socialism and tried to make it look like this foreign dictatorial kind of thing. So that's why we emphasize that, you know, if we don't have a democratic movement from the bottom up, by definition, that's socialism, and that's what we want. We're not looking at some kind of top-down dictatorship here. So in that sense, people are calling themselves democratic socialists. But I would say the majority of contributors to this book are people who aren't, you know, like social democracy, say, in Europe, that tendency has kind of gone along with the whole capitalist program. And in that sense, we're not social democrats. You could define a liberal, say, as someone who doesn't like what capitalism does but likes capitalism. We're not that at all. We're having a big book launch on January 27th at 7 o'clock at the Housing Works bookstore in Manhattan, in Soho. It's 126 Crosby Street, block south of Houston Street. We're having a book launch there, and we donated the books, and if people will come, they can get an inexpensive book. I think it's $10, and a bunch of us are going to be speaking there. Juan Gonzalez will speak, Francis Fox Piven, Francis Golden, me, Blanche Cook, and we'd like to get a chance to meet everybody, sign a copy of the book for them, and get it out there and get the discussion rolling.
So why don't you tell us about at least one of your favorite essays in this compilation?
There's a chapter in the book by Kazembe Balogun. My friend and comrade used to run the programming at the Breck Forum. It's called We Be Talking Marx Where I Come From. And he talks about the long tradition in the black community of black socialists. And it goes back to Paul Robeson and James Baldwin, and Martin Luther King, of course, said that if we were going to have true justice in this country, we have to have some kind of democratic socialism. And then he reads a quote from Malcolm X, who, before he was assassinated, was moving towards socialism. And Malcolm said, you can't have a chicken lay a duck's egg. And this country, this society, its economic system, its racism, is what it is. And it can't lay a duck's egg. And if they ever did, it would be a plenty revolutionary chicken. And I heard Malcolm X speak. I was in college at the University of Wisconsin back in 63, and he came out to speak there. That was one of the great influences of my life. I did poverty law for the Peace Corps in Detroit afterwards in the inner city, and I got the book Malcolm X Speaks, which Pathfinder published, and then the other book, Malcolm X, Evolution of a Revolutionary, written by George Brightman. And I got those two books in all the bookstores in Detroit. So that's been a great influence on my life, and I look upon getting this book out as really a fulfillment of 50 years of working in that direction.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you'll find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. And while you're there, check out the latest episode of Black Agenda Television. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the black left. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network, and especially to our engineer, Heather Content.
This is Black Agenda Radio, information for liberation.